So unfortunately, I'm going to have to tell you that I'm the pinch hitter this morning, and I'm not the one that put together this presentation, but we had some budget constraints and could only send one person from our state health department. So Catherine couldn't be here this morning, but I'm going to talk about the adverse event surveillance that we set up to look at severe adverse events temporally associated to H1N1 vaccine receipt. And I was involved in this project in the early stages, but was out on maternity leave for the late stages. So hopefully I can cover all the important points and answer your questions. So the objectives of our surveillance project were to investigate and identify any severe adverse events that were reported shortly after receipt of H1N1 vaccine. And we also wanted to just understand a surveillance system, you know, that we could use to monitor these types of severe events. VAERS is out there and CISA does some monitoring, but we wanted to do a little more enhanced surveillance within our state health department. So as you all know, when H1N1 vaccine was first rolled out, there was a lot of concern about safety. Certainly there were the concerns about Guillain-Barré syndrome because of the 1976 epidemic. And we estimated that in California we had about 8.8 million doses that were actually administered, and that would have been about 56% of the total doses that were distributed in the state. So in order to address some of these concerns from the public, from the media, we wanted to establish this enhanced surveillance system. So we looked at serious events that were temporally associated with vaccine receipt. And I just wanted to put temporally in emphasis because we don't really know if these were actually associated with the vaccine at all. But they were events that were reported that had occurred shortly after the vaccine was received. And then we also set up a parallel system to separately monitor all incident cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, to do a specific surveillance project around that syndrome because of these concerns. And I'm not going to go into that at all. If you have questions about that, you can certainly contact Catherine. I'll have her information on the last slide. That was done in parallel with the EIP project, which some of you might be familiar with. So we defined a severe adverse event as death, a life-threatening illness, hospitalization for more than 24 hours, or prolongation of a current hospitalization, permanent disability, pregnancy-related, such as a miscarriage or some sort of outcome that would be undesirable, non-GBS neurologic complication, anaphylaxis, or other medical condition. So our process was that we received reports from VAERS. We also received reports directly from clinicians and from local health departments, and some of those reports were coming from patients themselves. And then we also had these other surveillance systems. So we had the Guillain-Barré syndrome surveillance system. Then we also have an established project called the California Encephalitis Project that received severe cases referred into that project for testing. And some of those had received vaccine closely related to their onset. So we included those in the project. And we initially reviewed them with a team of staff at CDPH from various branches to look and try to categorize them into these five categories. So we had, non-GBS related but neurological events, anaphylaxis, pregnancy related, death, and then other. It was just the catch-all. And then we investigated these by trying to obtain medical records, doing a very aggressive follow-up, obtaining specimens if possible to do additional testing at the state level. And we worked very closely with local health departments, clinicians, trying to obtain all of this additional information. So the project took place for 1 year. And in that time, we had 1,000 suspected adverse events that were reported of all types. And the main source of those was from VAERS. And of these, 119 were considered serious. They met our definition. Four of them had died, 20 reports of anaphylaxis, 23 pregnancy-related, 57 that were neurological but not GBS, and 19 that fell into that other category. So the first death really highlights the whole point of doing the surveillance project. So shortly after the vaccine was first rolled into the states, and it was within the first 2 weeks of doses actually being administered, we received a report of a young girl, a 9-year-old female with Down syndrome and also leukemia, that died 6 days after receiving her LAIV vaccine. And this was concerning. We were concerned. Obviously, we were afraid the media would get a hold of this and people would start panicking. Luckily, we were able to find additional specimens to do testing at the state, and we were able to determine that she actually died of wild-type pandemic influenza in conjunction with strep pneumonia. So luckily, we were able to attribute her death to the disease itself and not the vaccine. And this was a really important thing for us to be able to do and to encourage our vaccination efforts, because this could have been a big deal breaker for a lot of people. Another death that was reported was a 42-year-old woman with some underlying health conditions, and she had received both a seasonal and H1N1 vaccine in October. In November, she had shortness of breath and was hospitalized in December, and she died in early December, and her final diagnosis was cardiac arrest, but we weren't able to obtain any specimens or do any additional testing for her. Our third death was a 16-month-old that was delayed on his vaccination schedule, so he had received a whole bunch of vaccines all at once in early November, and he actually was found the next morning unresponsive in his crib. He had evidence of emesis and aspiration. He'd had a history of a febrile seizure, and it was thought that he likely had had a febrile seizure during the night. The fourth death was a 56-year-old male. He had history of heart disease, and he received an activated vaccine in January and had cardiac arrest 2 days later. Again, we were not able to collect specimens. We had 20 cases of anaphylaxis that met our criteria for anaphylaxis, and we used the Brighton criteria to try to categorize these. The Brighton Collaboration Group sets these vaccine safety standards, and they do put case definitions for severe adverse events for GBS, anaphylaxis, and also encephalitis. And level 1 is considered the most severe, and level 3 is the least severe. So most of our cases of anaphylaxis fell into the level 1 and 2 criteria. They were fairly young. Median age was 23 years. Majority were female, and 3 actually required hospitalization. We used our cutoff for the time period of anaphylaxis to be up to 120 minutes, and most cases of anaphylaxis happen early on, so shortly after vaccine was received, the median range was 20 minutes. And most had received an activated vaccine. And 9 of them had also received seasonal flu vaccine within four weeks of H1N1 vaccine, and 4 of those actually received that on the same day. There were 23 pregnancy-related events. 6 of them were stillbirth, 16 were miscarriage, and 1 was a congenital anomaly. And we didn't do additional testing on the pregnancy-related events at the state. We just simply wanted to count them and monitor them, but we didn't do any additional follow-up aside from just receiving this information. The median time from vaccination to onset for these, or of the event, was 9 days. Most had received an activated vaccine, but 2 had received LAIV. And 8 had also received seasonal flu vaccine, and 5 had received that on the same day. And we had 57 neurologic events that were not considered GBS. And of these, 11 were a post-infectious encephalitis or myelitis. Most of these were, I think most were Bell's palsy. Oh, no, that's for the cranial nerve palsy. Most of those are Bell's palsy. We had 18 seizure and 14 that fell into an other category. Median age was 16 years. About half were female. And many had had an underlying medical condition, which included a history of febrile seizures or some other neurologic complication that may have put them at higher risk for having this sort of event. 24 of these did require hospitalization. The time from vaccination to onset of this event was 3 days, and most had received an activated vaccine. And 26 had also received seasonal flu vaccine. 9 had received it on the same day. Then we had 19 that fell into this other category, and you can see what those were listed out here. And some of these are interesting. The case that had the liver transplant had a rejection of the liver, and they'd had no major complications in 20 years. The liver transplant was 20 years prior, and so they thought that that could somehow be related to the vaccine receipt. So we were only able to obtain specimens on 11 of our cases, but of those 11, we were able to identify possible infectious etiologies for 8. Of these, the one I already spoke about, the fatal case, we were able to find that she had both Streptococcus pneumoniae and pandemic influenza A. And we had a second case that had that same profile that had both strep pneumo and H1N1 wild type. There was a case that had simply H1N1 and one with rhinovirus, and then we had a case with Mycoplasma pneumoniae, two with herpes simplex virus 1 that was identified, and one with MMDAR antibody identified. So our observed rates are listed here in this first column. And you can see them compared to the expected rates. And our observed rates are based on administered doses that we are estimating in California. And again, we used about 56% of our doses that were distributed in the state to come up with our estimate of administered doses. And that was based on data that we received from 4,000 medical providers in the state. And overall, our observed rates are not very different than what we expect, and in many cases, it's quite lower than what we would have expected. And this is actually, I think, very reassuring, especially considering the bias that could have gone into such reporting of over-reporting of these types of events with such heightened media, with such heightened awareness among the public and among clinicians. And yet we still had very low incidence of events reported. So overall, we concluded that rates of severe adverse events were not occurring at an increased rate after receipt of H1N1 vaccination, that anaphylaxis rates that were received after H1N1 were not greater than what we typically see for seasonal influenza, and for a subset of our cases, we were able to identify these alternate etiologies, which is a very important thing to consider moving forward in terms of trying to investigate these types of cases. Our limitations is that there's always difficulty when interpreting VAERS data. You don't know your denominator. It's hard to understand how many doses are administered in your community. And it wasn't clear to us how good our compliance was with reporting from local health departments and from clinicians. And it's always difficult to obtain specimens, and you really need to either get the specimen that is already sitting in the lab, that's already been collected, which are usually tossed within 5 days or sometimes faster than that, or you're trying to get additional specimens collected from a patient, which can be very difficult if these are not reported timely. So that's a limitation that we have moving forward if we're trying to continue this type of surveillance. I want to thank our partners in the local health departments who really helped us conduct the surveillance and those at CDPH who helped design and actually do the work to do this project. If you have any specific questions or any additional questions about the Guillain-Barré syndrome surveillance project, you can contact Catherine Salabé, my colleague, or I can welcome to take questions as well.
Thank you.